with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Thank you for joining us today. Today is April 6th, 2017. Wow, how fast the year goes. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for sharing our radio station with other people. You do have to remind them that we're on the internet. I guess we're considered the alternative radio. I actually consider us the real radio, the real information, not alternative. The alternative is the alternative facts we get on mainstream media. So you got to figure out what's real on this station and on this show for sure. You get the real deal. And sometimes it's not easy to listen to. And for that reason, we thank you for joining us. Today we have with us a returning friend of our show, Jackie Kreppel from Fighters for Life. Her organization is the only organization that I know of that pays for people's daily needs, not their medical costs while they're going through cancer treatment and making an effort to survive through that horrendous deal. So thank you, Jackie, for joining us again.
Thank you for having me, Lonnie. Very nice to be here today.
Yeah, it's really great. So why don't you go over a little bit again with our listeners exactly what Fighters for Life does. And how can people reach you? Because there are many people out there who are suffering from cancer who have no idea where to turn and how to turn. So why don't you give them an idea of how they can reach you?
Sure. Well, I'm available through our website, which is fightersforlife.org. That's fighters, F-I-G-H-T-E-R-S, the number four, life, L-I-F-E.org. O-R-G. And you can reach out through the website to contact me if you're looking for help or you're looking for help for a loved one. You can also reach me on my cell number. That's area code 661-390-8410. And you can look us up through Google, look up cancer care, cancer help, and that should pull us up there on the web as well.
Okay. Well, when people call you, what kind of questions will they be asked? I mean, what is it that you exactly provide? Tell them exactly what your organization provides.
Sure. So we offer emotional and financial support for cancer fighters during active treatment, their families and their caregivers. And we really aim to do the full service. I like to get to know the patients, their story, their families, their diagnosis, and then we take a look at where they're at in their treatment, what their needs are in terms of financial and emotional support. And then based on our funding, of course, we offer the kind of help that they need individually. Now, we do require that they are nominated by their oncology team, in particular their oncologist, their head doctor, to verify that they are indeed in treatment, where they're at in their treatment, and how we can help them. So that's the basic idea of it. Everybody who's in active treatment is eligible for help. It, of course, is based on funding and what it is that we can do to help them. We primarily focus on paying bills, utilities, mortgage, rent payments, things that I think are so incredibly hard to even fathom when a patient is fighting for their life. And you're trying to maintain, you know, this normal life. You have a house and a family and responsibility and things that need to be handled, and yet you're also fighting for your life, and it requires so much of your emotional and physical energy that it's very difficult to focus on the other realities at the time. And quite frankly, in fairness to a cancer fighter, really what they need to be focusing on is getting well and healing and fighting and surviving and doing what they can to make it through this what I call, you know, the train wreck effect, which is you get the diagnosis and then it's like this ripple effect for at least a few years. I mean, that's the basic minimum. Most people continue to see their oncologist every year, every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, for at least 5 years. So that's a reality for 5 years, where obviously my organization can't help you that long, but it can help you through the first phase, which is really the most trying and most difficult for most families. Not all, but most.
Well, what's the typical, explain to us, give us an example of a typical case, is there even a typical case? Are they all individually different?
Well, no, they of course are all very individually different. You have different age variables, different staging, different personalities, different emotional capabilities. It's all very individual. And that's, you know, that's kind of where we run into difficulties with your standard protocols for cancer, because each patient is individual. We are cellularly individual. And so when you're dealing with specific protocols, yes, as a whole, this particular chemo treatment might help, you know, 75% of people with diffused large B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. However, it doesn't necessarily help all of the patients as a whole. So in every aspect of a cancer journey, it's very individual.
Mm-hmm. And well, how did you get into this, Jackie? How did this idea come up to you?
Now, we talked a little bit about this our last time, and I'm glad to be able to sort of recap, because I think when you first start talking about this, you kind of forget certain things, and so I'm excited that you asked me about that. In 2010, my husband was diagnosed with diffused large B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it was a stage 2B. But before we found out that the staging and exactly what it was, we spent a week in Cedars-Sinai Hospital and was basically told to go home and get our things in order and prepare to lose Michael.
Wow.
And that was just the beginning of the train wreck as we moved through Michael's journey. We were also financially hit very hard, and I had reached out to many organizations for help and support. And really, I found myself kind of up against this wall where I was getting boxes of paraphernalia, you know, bracelets and magnets for my refrigerator and a lot of things like that. And I thought to myself, now, I mean, really what would have been the most helpful for my family was maybe a gas card or $25 worth of food. And that's what inspired Michael and I to kind of sit down and think about, you know, what would be a good service to help people? How could we continue on to help people? Looking at what we were going through, we both just went, there's just got to be a gift in this, because this is so awful that there must be something more to why we're going through this. So we sat down and talked about what were the things that we were seeing that concerned us throughout our journey. And this was one of them, one where, you know, even a $100 card or paying the gas bill, one less thing to think about when you're focusing on healing and focusing on fighting. And that's sort of where the concept of fighters bloomed from, and then it grew from there. It started out as that little sort of, okay, this might be something we can do, and then we just built on it. And the more that we embraced that and built it and started talking to people and helping people, the more that we could see that need and we could fill that need. And then it just sort of kind of became its own thing. And now I sort of follow along with you know, how it unfolds and the people it brings in on its own. And it's been an incredible journey. It's been a huge learning curve and a wonderful experience to be able to support people that in those first few months are just reeling from that diagnosis and from that reality.
So if somebody out there listening knows someone who has cancer, they can contact you, go to your website. And then is there like an application? What's the process for getting helped?
Okay, so the first thing that you do is you contact Fighters for Life. That sends me the email, says that you are a friend, a caregiver, a family member, or the cancer fighter itself looking for support. That engages a phone call and a conversation. And then we talk for a while to sort of see, okay, if it's the friend, what's the story, what's going on? Are they as engaged as the friend to get help? Because sometimes friends call me and they say, listen, I think you could help them, but I don't know if they're ready for your help. So there is your first fork in your branch and how you decide to proceed. And then if somebody does want to proceed with seeking help, we send out an application. It's a very simple application. The most important criteria is that you are in active treatment and you are nominated by an oncologist and their team. I need to verify that information. So I do want to make
that thing about being nominated, that kind of makes me that, you know, how does a person get nominated? When you have this idea in your head that you need help, you go to your oncologist. I mean, do they give you a written prescription or what?
They take the application. There's a part in the form where your oncologist and the nurse fill out the information stating that you are in active treatment, that they feel that they would benefit greatly from the help from our organization. And they sign off just verifying, yes, this patient is in active treatment. They do have cancer and they would very much benefit from a program like ours.
Okay. So then they send that to you after they get your application, take it to the doctor, and then they send you the application.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. And then you call them, and then how long do you stay engaged with them? Like, how long can you help them?
Well, it's all based on the funding. Generally, what I do at this point in the game is I take whatever funding is available and I help that patient with whatever I can in that time, in that donation time right there. At the point of where Fighters for Life is now, I generally do a one-time help for each person. And again, it's based on funding, but I am always there for them forever. I'm committed to my fighters forever, whether I can help them financially or not moving forward. I will always be there emotionally. I'm working with a patient now who I actually talked briefly about in our last interview. I helped her walk through the transition of her cancer fighter, her husband, and I continue to help her. I go to her house once a week. I'm helping her learn how to re-engage in her life. Her husband took care of all the bills, paid all the bills, and was in charge of all of the financing and kind of all this, just the hard stuff. And so she's really had to relearn how to be an independent woman, how to run the farm, how to engage in dealing with people again. So I'm committed for life for any of my fighters on an emotional aspect, always.
Now, what you're talking about in funding, limited funding, is that this is a formal nonprofit, right?
That's correct.
So if there's any benefactors out there that want to lay $100,000 or $500,000 on Jackie's organization, please do, because cancer fighters really need the help. If there was more money in your organization, you could certainly take care of a lot more needs than just a one-time help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the whole concept, too, is that on our website, we show our fighters. One of the things that I found was so important to me is that I know that we all give to certain organizations. We all, most of us do. We want to give and we want to help. What I'm wanting to do with Fighters is to be able to show the donors who they're helping. Because I know that with a lot of the larger organizations, a lot of the money goes to running the organization, goes to a lot of people who work. It's not as much volunteer. You have your executives, people who run these large multi-million dollar 501c3s. And what I'm looking to accomplish and what's so important to me through Fighters is that the donors get to see where their money is going. They get to see the people that they're helping. And I think that especially for people now who still like to give, but they don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they're going to give money that, you know, they don't necessarily have to give. Well, I think it's important for them to say, okay, if I give to Fighters for Life, I get to go look month to month and see these fighters and these people and their stories that I'm helping. And I think that's really important for donors.
It is actually really important. And I think this is such a needed thing. People don't understand when we say the rug gets pulled out from under you when you have cancer. This is part of the rug that people don't expect. It's bad enough to get a diagnosis that basically says, unless you do something, you're going to die. Right? Unless you have some massive intervention that's painful and may not work, you're still going to die. But aside from that, when they get that, as they get sick, because a lot of people probably think they can just keep working, don't they?
Yeah, a lot of people do, and a lot of people do continue to work.
Right.
There are people that can continue to work, and there are people that can. That's, again, where it comes into such an individual journey.
Right, right. Well, the other part of it is, even if you're working, there are things, I mean, you may not be able to work as much, and so you don't need a lot of help. You don't need someone to pay for your month of food. But a bill here, a bill there might be a big, huge help off of your mind. And that's where, even though there's not lots of funds because it's a brand new, this organization is relatively new, right, Jackie?
Yeah, I got my determination letter in 2014.
Right.
So, and it's been primarily myself. I do have some people come on board who are interested in coaching other people with their same cancer. But the organization is run by myself.
Wow.
Which is okay. We're just keep on one foot in front of the other a million more times until to the point where we can really help more. Now, even with where we're at, I do want to say, and I forgot to bring this up, we have moved into the global community in terms of help. Last year, we teamed up with a number of other organizations and participated in bringing the first cancer treatment center to the Horn of Africa, to Tanzania. We broke ground last January, and it's been building and growing, and it's moving along really great. So we are part of the global community, and we continue to strive to be more of a part of the global community as well.
How did you get involved in that? That's interesting. Is there, obviously, I guess in Tanzania, there's cancer everywhere on the planet.
Well, cancer is now one of the number one killers in Africa, and it has gone so untreated. And the thing is, you know, we were seeing people coming in and getting cancer diagnoses at the time when it had already completely been stage four. It's been out of control. Essentially, these families were going home to their villages to die, where these cancers could have been treated, particularly pediatric cancer. So that's really what our primary focus on is pediatric. I have a whole pediatric team, and it's really quite...
By pediatric, you mean children.
I mean children. That's correct.
Yeah.
Because
how did you get engaged with people in Africa? That's kind of a curveball for me. How did you get involved with people in Africa?
Well, this story is really quite fun. A few years ago, excuse me for the dates, because I hadn't actually sat down and wrote everything down before this. So in 2011, I found this amazing organization called Above and Beyond Cancer. And I talked with a gentleman by the name of Charlie Whitmack, who was spearheading this whole project. I will cut to the chase and say that they were doing this wonderful thing for cancer fighters. And Michael I put the application in for Michael and he was accepted. They took 42 cancer survivors and their caregivers to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. And so Michael did this journey.
While he was sick.
He did this between chemotherapy and radiation. So yeah, there were a lot of patients that were, you know, in remission, some still fighting cancer, some of their caregivers, sons, daughters, husbands, wives, they all climbed together this amazing journey to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. So there began our connection with Tanzania. And then I worked with, thankfully, Charlie, who's this amazing humanitarian. He's done so many things all over the world. Kind of took me under his wing, and he really supported me and helped me to work through my application process. He's really been an incredible mentor for me since the Tanzania journey. And so he was a big part of me successfully getting fighters off the ground. And then we spoke a couple of years ago, and he talked about doing this project in Tanzania and asked if fighters would like to come on board. So we absolutely did. And that's how the connection to Tanzania happened. And of course, really, Charlie is the spearhead here for it. But I was so honored to be asked to come on board and participate and be part of such an incredible thing to, you know, to help a whole region, the Horn of Africa, that is gigantic. So it's wonderful. The hospital is in Tanzania. It is near Kilimanjaro. It's incredible.
So this is how it's his trip to Kilimanjaro that basically got the whole ball rolling there.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So this is actually one of the issues that I know about Africa in my research on nuclear. And I mean, you've known me for a long time. This is full disclosure. I met Jackie. She's a tax client of mine. And as this progressed, and when I got the radio show and it kind of got established, I said, man, you really ought to come on. So this is how I ended up meeting her. Right. But one of the things that I've discovered in my new research on nuclear is that Africa is teeming with uranium mines that are filthy. The uranium, when you said that it's the cancer is killing one of the, you know, children over there die all the time from cancer, it's because they use children in the mines. They go in there with nothing on. They just wear their shorts and they don't even protect people over there. It is the outrageousness of how those governments. When we say lack of regulation in Africa, that's the word lack doesn't even come into it. It's none. They're really literally, it's if you have money, you get to mine and you get to do whatever you want. So Africa is one of those places where really I wish that we could get more effort to, I don't know, hold them accountable. Like in our own country, like one of the hardest parts for me with having Rick Perry as the Department of Energy is that there's no accountability. I mean, he oversaw one of the worst nuclear waste accidents in Texas. And instead of finding that company, he went very easy on them and ended up on their board of directors until very recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, uranium mining, it's subtle. You don't just die immediately because it's nuclear. You get sick. It looks like a lot of symptoms of a bunch of other things, and then you get sick.
Well, because it's cumulative. So yeah, it's over time, and you might have certain things come up that can't really be connected to that until one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and then collectively, it's like, oh, okay. Now you have cancer.
I don't know, Jackie. You guys have been through this process on the whole cancer train. I personally, do you think it's worth it to get all of their treatment? Do you think that it really, I mean.
Well, you know, I can't say it is or it isn't. That, again, is a very individual decision. You know, for I can speak for how Michael and I did it and why we did what we did. And that's the only voice that I can speak for. And that for us was, you know, Michael was 40. He was young. It was aggressive. We were given a short time to live. We had to make decisions very quickly. We had young children. We had a lot of reasons why we chose the road we chose. And I'll tell you one of the conversations that we had, and that's part of where our decisions came from, where it's just like, at this point in the game, I didn't want to bury my husband and then turn around and go, I should have tried it. For me, that was a pretty powerful emotion and feeling and thought that sort of pushed us towards, yes, we'll do both. We'll do Eastern and Western. It is so incredibly scary to get that cancer diagnosis and to understand how you should treat it. Now, some people are adamant. They absolutely don't want to do the chemicals. They want to go holistic, and they're willing to take that risk. Holistic treatments are much harder to reach here in the States, certainly. But I'm not saying that. I think it's a personal choice. I think you have to decide, are you willing to potentially get a different cancer from the treatments that you're getting? Is it worth the time you're taking? Or do you want to take the risk and go holistic? Now, there are lots of holistic treatments out there that are successful, but they're not reachable for everybody. It just depends on your absolute individual situation. And there, in my opinion, there is no right or wrong way to do it for yourself and your family. You have to be okay with your decision, and you need to push forward and go for whatever it is you choose. This brings me to an interesting conversation, because I have these conversations with my fighters and their families right off the bat. I'm very honest and upfront, and I tell everybody involved, especially the caregivers and family, you know, we're here to support our cancer fighters, but we have to understand that they are in charge of their treatment. If they get to the point where they are done, then that is the law. If the fighter turns to the family and says, I don't want to fight this anymore, that's the law. That's their choice. And we as caregivers and family members need to support these fighters in whatever they feel they need to do. If they say, I don't want to do chemo radiation, I'm only doing holistic, okay. That's their choice, and that's their journey, and that's okay. So again, it all comes down to very individual choices and how you see your treatment proceeding. I think it's all right if it's right for the cancer fighter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, actually. It does make sense. I mean, it is the person's life. And I respect that, because really it does bring it down to, are you really willing to go through this? And nobody can say whether it's worth it or not worth it, because it's not their life. But this is what we're talking about. It's your own. This is such a grave issue. Now, let me ask you about the cost of cancer and how that works in people's lives. And then on a greater global issue, since you bring up Africa, is the cancer treatment in Africa paid for by the state?
Well, no, these have been mostly volunteer, all fundraising. The doctors that are going over there are giving their time. All of the equipment that we got is all outdated equipment here in the United States, which is completely state-of-the-art equipment. But our technology is moving and progressing so quickly that something that's worth using this year is out of date and out of technology here in America. So all of the radiology equipment, all of those things that were donated for this, all came from the States, from us. But it's all volunteer, and I'm sure that once it's established, there will be a certain amount of funding that comes from Africa and Tanzania, Africa, to keep it going. But it is very minimal compared to what you would pay here. And in all truth, treatments in other countries are much, much cheaper than they are here in the States. For example, I had a cancer fighter who's no longer with us, bless her heart, cancer fighter Kim, who had a rare eye cancer called choroidal melanoma. And we worked very, very hard to get her treatment here. There was only three doctors.
Where is here?
Here in California.
Okay, what part? Upper and north? Southern?
In Los Angeles.
Okay.
I'm not going to name names. I'm going to keep it vague. But there was a doctor here who absolutely could have done the treatment and refused to do the treatment because I had gotten the cancer fighter through the state insurance. So we looked into treatment in France because there's an eye institute.
Wait a minute. He didn't want to work on her because he wasn't going to get paid enough by the state, essentially.
That's correct.
Wow.
That's correct. Wow. All that doctor needed to do was sign this one piece of paper, and we could have had her treatment right away. So here,
wow, one person, all he had to do is give up the profit on one patient and he would not do it.
Correct.
Wow. Correct.
And wow. So the treatment here in America was $44,000. The same treatment in France was $14,000.
Oh my God.
Now we eventually did get her the treatment here. However, unfortunately, it was too late. And the cancer had, a lot of cancers have places that they go. They start in one area, but most cancers have a place that they go. Lung cancer will go to your brain. Choroidal melanoma goes to the liver. They all kind of have a place where they start and where they go to.
So say that again. Tell me about this, because a lot of people really don't understand the symptoms of cancer and how to get checked or why to get checked and the effects on other parts of your body. Explain, what do you mean it goes to your brain or it goes to your kidney? What does that mean? Your liver, what does that mean?
Well, generally speaking, most cancers start in one place and then navigate throughout the body. Most cancers have a place where they begin and a very typical place where they navigate to. So lung cancer typically will navigate to the brain. Choroidal melanoma typically, you'd think being in the eye that it would go to the brain, but it doesn't. It actually navigates to the liver. So for her, it went to the liver, and unfortunately we lost her a couple of years ago. And that was so frustrating because we could have raised the money to send her to France. But in the amount of time that we could have done that, we ended up getting her treatment in Chicago from a great doctor in Chicago. But because the doctor in Los Angeles had refused to treat her, it took us, 6 months to get her the treatment, where choroidal melanoma typically is a very slow progressing cancer. It's very slow, and you can have time to deal with it. Hers wasn't like that. It was very aggressive. It moved very quickly through her body. So, there is that. It's the cost for people's cancer depends on so many variables. It depends on what kind of cancer, how many specialists, what's your insurance, what are your co-pays, what are the medications that are paid for. There's no way to say, well, for this family, you're definitely going to pay $300,000 for your cancer. It's just not that way. It's again, here you are with that extreme individual situation.
So this is interesting. You said that in cancer it costs $14,000. I thought in Europe they had socialized healthcare where people don't have to pay. That's what we hear all the time.
Well, yeah, but you can't come in as an American and jump on their socialized.
Oh, if she was a French person, she would have gotten treatment immediately. In other words,
she will. I've never dealt with the system over there, so I don't know how immediate it is for somebody to go through their healthcare system. All I know is that if we wanted to go there and pay for it, it was $14,000.
Wow.
That's all I know. I'm not sure how it all works over there. I've never.
And so that's the kind of thing that you would have helped her pay for.
Yes, I would have raised money to get her there. Now
you did. You helped her get to Chicago.
I went to Chicago with her and stayed with her during treatment.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, look, this is what I mean. When our listeners hear this radio show, it's, I hope that people will share this information with their friends and family, because there are benefactors. There are people who have done quite well, and they love to give money to great causes. And, I personally have clients who have given $20,000, $30,000 to an organization that they think is correct. So I know it's real. These are not, you don't have to go, there's no, I mean, I know that there's a very cumbersome sponsor, what do they call them, scholarship or grant writing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are cumbersome processes to get money, because you write a grant and a proposal and it takes a year to get the funding. And in your case, the people in your organization that come to you for help cannot wait a year.
No, that's right. The people that come to me are in active treatment. They are in the midst, if not the beginning or the middle of their journey, and it's immediate need. It's immediate help and support. I can't tell you how vital that is to have the money available when I get somebody, because they can't wait, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm really, is there any other organizations? Yours is the only organization that I know of that does this kind of thing. Are there other ones in this country and other parts
absolutely.
Of the country?
There are absolutely other organizations that do great work for people. They are out there. You can search for them. In fact, so I wrote a book. I'm a published author, and my book is called Your Amazing Itty Bitty Cancer Book, and it's 15 essential steps to help you navigate your cancer diagnosis. This book is available in paperback. It's available on Amazon, Smashwords, iTunes, Page Foundry, and many more digital forums. Now, in this book, I talk a lot about different places you can get information, different websites you can look for help, how to search for clinical trials for your cancer, how to connect with people who support you in your cancer community based on your cancer diagnosis. It's really helpful to people.
What's the title again, Jackie?
Your Amazing Itty Bitty Cancer Book. And it's just a working, it's a very small book. It's a very easy read, but there are lots of information, lots of links, lots of websites that you can connect to get information.
On Amazon, it's $3 on Kindle, $7 in paperback. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's totally affordable, totally doable, and full of...
Well, the subtitle is 15 ways, 15 essential steps to help you navigate your cancer diagnosis.
Correct.
Wow. Well, that is awesome, Jackie.
I think that's kind of like when the doctor tells you you have cancer and you immediately go out of body. Like, you're like, okay, wow, what did the doctor say? You know? And I think our knee-jerk reaction is to run home and get on the internet, and that's just not the best thing to do. I think it's really important not to go on the internet right away. I mean, I did, and this is why I put that as my first thing, because it was such a rabbit hole. And by the end of the 5 hours I spent looking, because we hadn't gotten our official diagnosis yet, I mean, I was convinced that Michael had stomach cancer, which has a horrible survival rate. It's not a great survival rate, and all these other things. And it just sent me into this.
Oh, you mean when your doctor comes to you and says, I think you have cancer. You have to go get tested. The doctor doesn't know what you have, but they see something abnormal.
Right. Let's schedule for all these tests, and it's going to take a week, and then it's 2 weeks till you get your results. And in that time, you're going, oh my gosh, like, I need to find out what I have. But they don't do that. Just wait until you get your diagnosis, until you get the staging, and then you can start to go on the internet looking for information, primarily support. And you're going to be able to go to a website based on your cancer diagnosis, a community based on the cancer that you have. That is a much safer and much more logical place to get your information.
That's actually really good advice. What other kinds of tips can you tell people what are things that people should do when they first get something? I mean, that's a huge freak out for most people. They feel like they're going to die. Everyone says, well, I'm going to die. As soon as you get cancer, that's the indication is I'm going to die.
Yeah, well, yeah, that is the knee-jerk reaction. Absolutely. I think it's just important to try to slow things down a little bit. I think I felt like all of a sudden I was on the bullet train in Europe, and I couldn't slow it down, and everything was happening so quickly. And because also your family starts to get scared, and then your friends are scared. And, you know, I think it's important to just slow down and just sort of allow that those first few weeks for things to unfold, to get the test, to get the next thing, to not get so far ahead of yourself that you've already bought your coffin and had your burial rite prepared. And it's just important to slow down and just be as patient as you can in terms of getting the information. And then it's getting in action. Okay, now I know what I have. I know what kind of specialists I need. Let's make sure we have the right team. It's okay to get a second opinion. I write that in my book. It's important. If you feel like you want to get a second opinion, there's nothing wrong with that. And a good doctor, a good oncologist is going to go, okay, great. I think that's a great idea. Here's some doctors that also specialize in this field. Why don't you give them a call? Or just being supportive of that. It's the doctor that says, well, I think that's ridiculous. Why would you get a second opinion? Where you go, well, I'm definitely getting a second opinion now. Because it's okay to do that.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people feel like they're sort of betraying their doctor if they go find somebody else.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's not the case. And any good doctor would say, I encourage you to get a second opinion, because they should feel confident in the care that they're giving you, that it shouldn't be a big deal for you to go somewhere else, that you'll probably come back to them because they're your connection, and it's the same diagnosis and the same story.
Well, you know, there's a lot of children in St. Louis right now. Children are dying, and it's very sad. This is the hardest part for me. I think about St. Louis every single day. I mean, St. Louis is the heart of America, and I have discovered that the people of St. Louis really have a very gentle and reflective soul there. Everybody I've talked to there, they're deeply committed to staying in St. Louis, and even people whose houses are contaminated with radioactivity and always will be. The government is now passing through legislation, although there's no funding for it, but there's passing legislation to move people living within 1 mile of a nuclear burning dump site. Not five, not, well, actually it's 3 miles. They've given in, it, you know, not even 10 miles. So, and there's about 300,000 people living within a 5 mile radius of it. They had secretly buried uranium from World War II that nobody knew about until Bechtel and Monsanto was dumping their stuff in a fuse wrap site. Now, we're saying that they did not know. They did know, because there's no way. It all belongs to the same government, right? But anyways, Bechtel was dumping their stuff in a fuse route, you know, in a waste dump site, essentially. And they did not follow their own best practices. And the chemicals that they dumped 300 feet under caught fire.
Oh, my.
And so when this smoke started happening, they started putting things together. The way the community found out was by the citizens who connected through Facebook, noticed they all had the same rare cancers. And the reason I found out about it, how severe it was I actually went to Facebook, I saw a post, and I started digging around. There was this little 12-year-old girl who had just died from cancer, and her mother posted a picture. It is sad. Even yesterday, their representative from that district, their state representative, her name is Representative Nadal Chappelle, she posted a picture of what looked like a 7 or 8 year old girl who had just died from cancer. And wow. A lot of those people have nowhere to turn. The system fails them miserably. Even, well, obviously it's failing them right now. It's allowing them to live right next door to a nuclear. I mean, the government still says, a year ago, when I first heard about this in 2015, they said it was 1,000 feet away. Think of the logical progression, okay. 1,000 feet away. About this time last year, they said it was 300 feet away from the smoldering event. That's what the EPA calls it, is a smoldering event. It's not really a fire, but it's still burning out of control. They are at least now covering it with a tarp. What the government had done in World War II is just covered it up. But Jackie, this is the thing, that people there have no idea how to get help. Is there an outreach? Is there a way to get information, or have you posted on the Westlake Landfill page?
I have not.
Well, I'm going to post the Fighters for Life thing on the Westlake landfill. I'm going to post this interview there because I do have them coming here to speak on my radio show regularly, but I just intuitively know there's people there who need help. And there might even be people there who might be benefactors, you know, in that area, because we have cancer clusters all around this country.
All around the world, yes.
Yes, and the idea that people need help just to make it through, the financial help of paying your bills, paying your utility bills, getting, like you said, $25 worth of groceries makes a huge difference. The financial anxiety causes people more harm than any, you know, a lot as harmful as the cancer in many instances.
Absolutely. I believe attitude is a big part in survival. I think a good attitude, a fighting attitude, is a big part of survival. And I can tell you from my own experience that it was hard at times. It was hard to not connect everything together. It was hard to say, I'm sad about cancer, and then my refrigerator breaks and I have to get that fixed. And then because that breaks, then my dryer breaks and I have to get that fixed. And all of a sudden, all of these things all become one large problem, where when we're just kind of going through life, it's like, okay, your refrigerator breaks, you get a new one, it's okay. But when you're in the midst of cancer, it's like, well, it's all bad. Everything is breaking. Everything is falling apart. How could I possibly continue to move forward and keep going when all of these things just keep breaking and they're all a part of this big problem? But they're not. It's life, and life happens in the midst of having cancer, and it's just exasperated is what it is. So it's really important to remember that your cancer is your cancer and your life is your life. And it's important to just keep them separated as best as you can in terms of problems, and stay positive and just keep moving forward. It's so important.
Yeah. Well, that is the hardest part. The hard part about all of this. So tell us about a few of your survivors and a few of your, like, maybe not even survivors. Some of your success stories may be people who have not survived the cancer but had successful processes. So we have about 10 minutes left. If you could just share a couple stories on how, to show people how this process works.
Sure. Well, one of my youngest ones, her name is Dorothy. She was diagnosed at age 2 with Wilms-Turner disease, which is a disease of the kidney, except her tumor stretched from her kidneys and wrapped around her heart. And she went through extensive treatment. We went up to help them immediately. We brought them gift cards for Trader Joe's and gas cards. And she went through major, major treatment, chemotherapy. She went to Children's Hospital here in LA, had a massive surgery to opened her entire chest, removed the tumor that was going up and around her heart, radiated her heart for months. And she is cancer-free. She is moving on in her life, going to school, taking dance classes. Her mom was really strong and really amazing, an amazing family. And it was just, you know, it could have gone a lot of different ways for her. Many children with Wilms tumor do not survive. And if they do, they lose, a kidney, or they fight it later on in life. But her story is amazing. She is an amazing young girl, life-changing to meet her.
How did you help her family?
Both emotional support and some financial. We did gas cards because their trip, they had to drive from San Luis Obispo to Children's Cottage Hospital in Santa Barbara.
Wow. And how far is that for people who don't really understand the West Coast?
Well, it's about an hour to an hour and a half one way.
Okay.
Which for a young family, you know, a young family with a young child.
Yeah, $4 a gallon, that gets expensive. Yeah.
Very expensive. And then, of course, their trip here to Children's Hospital and their follow-ups there. But So we provided food and gas, and we went up for her birthday, brought her some birthday presents and spent some time with them, and took a lot of, spoke a lot of times with the mom on the phone just about, and You know, those are some of the things that I do in talking to people is telling them, you know, listen, you're getting a lot of help right now. You're in the early stages of your diagnosis, people. It's a heartstring diagnosis. She's a baby. You're going to get a lot of donations. But the reality is that you get a lot of donations in the beginning of your cancer journey. But as you continue on, the story becomes old news to people, and they sort of move on to the next critical person who's suffering. So even though you got some help in the first 6 or 8 months of your cancer diagnosis, those types of help start to dissipate and go away. Mm-hmm. So I always tell my fighters, listen, you need to be very careful with this funding that you're getting. Don't just pay everything off. Make it last, because your cancer is probably going to last a lot longer than the people who are donating for it. And that's really important, because you can go through it and go, oh my gosh, great, I get to pay this and do that and pay this and pay that. Well, yes, obviously there are bills that need to be paid, but it is very important to set, if you can set some of the money aside, some of the gift cards for gas aside, and not spend it all. In those days, in the 8, 9, 12 months time, when those donations stop coming in and you're still struggling to keep your patient in treatments and alive and the bills, it happens. You do find yourself at a certain point where everybody who's going to give is given, and it's not a bad thing, but it's a big time reality. So you have to be really careful and plan.
So can people find your book through your website? Is there a link on your website?
Absolutely. Yes.
Great.
Yep. And that there's information about the Tanzania project on there. There's our last radio show should be on there. There's cancer fighters, their testimonials, our story, all kinds of great fun information. We try to keep it updated as much as we can. And, you know, and again, that's a great way to reach out for yourself, for a friend, for a family member.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have, I mean, those are the kind of things like it, and it's very inexpensive. It's enough for someone to be able to buy and give to someone that you hear, because we are hearing more and more and more about cancer. I mean, it's not just the number one killer of kids. You know what I mean? It's, and frankly, a lot of the heart disease, this is an example. My sister had cancer, right? Mm-hmm. Well, they gave her, I mean, she was a terrible alcoholic, frankly. So what they did was they gave her this treatment for her thyroid cancer, and they killed the cancer. And as soon as she got out of cancer, she started drinking, like that day, right? Yeah. Well, the first year of her life, she had 6 blood transfusions because her liver kept failing. At the end of her life, she had a heart attack. She was laying on, she had done something, but she had a heart attack. So they listed her as dying from a heart attack. Now, fundamentally, she died from alcoholism. But medically, it all got started because she had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying? Like, it weakened her body. She went through all this treatment. I mean, they didn't mention anything because she wasn't completely finished with the cancer, but it wasn't the primary cause of her death.
Right.
And the other part of it is there's no oncology rates. Like they do not keep, like in a city, for example, I attempted to go to Sacred Heart to find out how many cancer deaths we have here. They said they don't keep track of it.
Well, the American Cancer Society does. And I will tell you that cancer is the second greatest killer disease in the world. 1 in 2 women and 1 in 3 men will be expected to contract cancer. So the American Cancer Society keeps a tab. They have an amazing site on statistics. And
I have to say, I really hate them. I personally, I know they help a lot of, or people say they help, but I like that. Like, for example, the way they keep their statistics covers up a lot of the nuclear lies. I think that cancer and nuclear go hand in hand. The reason that we have a cancer epidemic is because of the nuclear industry. For example, they don't ask people when they get cancer, you know, they don't keep statistics of where people were born in relation to their cancer epidemics. This is what happened with the people of St. Louis. At the Cold Water Creek, there's a group called Just the Facts, Please, the Cold Water Creek residents is called. They're they basically were the first people to really find out. We found out about Westlake Landfill because of the Coldwater Creek activists. And they were doctors and physicians. They were educated people who noticed they had this cancer and connected on Facebook. One of the things they realized is the way that we keep track of our cancer statistics is very elusive in finding out the real cause, because it's not where you died and you got cancer, it's where were you born, because cancer has a 4 to 80 year latency period.
Well, that's not entirely true, Lonnie. That's not entirely correct.
No, and this is where they use it. This is where the nuclear industry does use this whole... I mean, cancer can be caused by lots of other things, too. I mean,
it is.
Chemical treatment. I mean, it's just a litany of stuff.
You know what I mean? That's the thing, it's in this day and age, in the toxic environment, not only nuclear, but many other factors. And many factors in our food and pesticides. I mean, there are so many factors now, and all are bad and all are important. But you have to understand that really, in reality, what we're dealing with is that it takes a cancer cell 10 times to morph from a cell into a cancer cell, and that time depends on how much toxicity your body is getting and where you're getting it from, whether it's from a waste area, it's from the toxic food that we're eating. If you live in an area that has severe air pollution, carcinogens are carcinogens. They come from all over and from many different ways and many different forms. And essentially, we all have the potential to have cancer, but it is, again, that individual cellular form that reacts to the outside chemicals the way that it does. So that's why I believe that the Cancer Society isn't targeting exact things, because they're not going to target Monsanto. They're not going to target certain industries, because at the end of the day, they want to give information and they want to raise money to help people. And if they start targeting certain areas and doing what we would like them to do, they would lose their funding and lose their ability to continue to help people on the planet. That's unfortunate, but that's a reality.
Yeah, I get you. The coercion. That's what they do, is they operate on coercion.
Yeah, I mean, for me to go out and start targeting different people specifically and really being an activist against things, how much funding do you think I would get?
Yeah. I mean, I get you, but I think what we ought to do, that's another whole show we could talk about, Jackie. I mean, we have about a minute and a half left, so we can't even get into that. But I mean, I think what we really need to do is change the paradigm, like with that doctor who refused to operate on a patient because he's not getting paid enough by the state. It's a waste of his time. To save a human life, it's a waste of his time. That ought to be made illegal. In my view,
it was very, very sad.
We need to have a whole thing about ethics and start teaching adults about ethics again, perhaps. I mean, maybe that's why we got the Trump Nation, because we've lost that whole sense of morality and ethics again.
But I want to say on that, because I want to make sure that I say, okay.
I hope you say it. We have 45 seconds left.
Okay. We may not have the choice we want, but there are choices out there. There are people out there that will help. Do not give up. Look, keep looking, because there was a doctor somewhere that was willing to help her. There are doctors out there that are willing to help, and we must just keep searching and trying and working as a community to help each other. That's the most.
Amen. Important. And I say, put your courage feet on. You've been listening with Jackie Kreppel, fightersforlife.org. The link will be in the show. Thank you for joining us. And I really appreciate you listening to us. Please take action, lean into democracy. We can save our planet. Thanks for listening, you guys.